So this is part six of the Religion in America sermon series that we have been diligently working through these last 6 months or so. That means we only have one more left, so we're in the home stretch, people. And this sermon has changed its topic several times as I have tried to respond to current events and what religion in America means now as opposed to what it meant 6 months ago. And I decided that you can't really talk about religion in America today without talking about the role and relationship of religious leaders to and with political figures and political parties. I want to start by talking about Jeremiah Wright, Barack Obama's pastor, as an example, and move on from that, hopefully, in a way that will be helpful. And when the whole firestorm about Jeremiah Wright, who incidentally I have heard preach and is amazing, when the whole firestorm started, way back when, some months ago, my first thought was not, "Dear Lord, this man is crazy." It wasn't even, "This will do terrible things for his pals campaign." Instead, it was a sharp and meaningful self-indictment that has not gone away even now. Because when I heard him say, in one of the more controversial clips that could be gleaned from a 36-year career as a preacher, when I heard him say that Jesus was a man of color, oppressed by the Roman people of power, that the same oppression applied today as held sway back then, that this nation is as broken and as oppressive to racial and religious minorities as was Rome in the first century, I thought to myself, I should have had the guts to say that too. I should have had the guts to call out the brutal truth onto the floor of our collective reality, to own the fact that the same European, pale-skinned, wealthy people who were in power then are still in power now. I should have had the guts to say that. And yet I did not. And why not? Because I, like so many preachers in this day and age, find myself at some remove from the tradition in which Reverend Wright did most of his controversial preaching. A tradition too forceful, too strange, too extreme, and sometimes too damn mean to emanate easily from the mouth of a nice, young, white lady preacher in America. I speak of the prophetic tradition. The lineage of the Hebrew prophets, men like Isaiah, who called his own nation the great harlot, and Ezekiel, who said that the young lion of Israel had grown to become a man-eater, and prophet Jeremiah, this preacher's own namesake, who said to his own people that you have accustomed your steps to walk with crime, to the point when your hands display the stains from the blood of innocent men. I speak of the men who said things like that to their own nation because they loved it. The tradition of the Hebrew prophets is not comfy. It is not cozy. It is not a literary and religious inheritance in which preachers preach what the people want to hear. Nor is it, as is commonly misunderstood, simply some texts in which dismal men foretell dark futures. It is a tradition of fiery, strange, and invective-filled preachers who actually cared enough for their city, their people, and their faith to try to save it by any means necessary, including insulting just about everyone, and most especially the people who wielded political power. The prophets of the Hebrew tradition did not heap their scorn upon others, but spoke critically from within their own communities, from inside of it, because they loved it. They understood that the only way to affect the kind of change they sought was to be deliberately and unapologetically provocative. One fellow minister has described the task of the prophetic preacher as something akin to that of a person trying to break the grip of alcoholism on someone they love. How do you get through when someone you love is so blinded by their own addiction and their own self-injury? Is it with niceness? With gentle pats upon the head? And permissive, enabling behaviors that allow the death-dealing lie to go unabated? No. It is hard, cold, honest truth that bursts through the bubble of silence and brings the full measure of the problem to the surface so that the one you love might be made whole again. The Hebrew prophets preached to their own nation, a nation that they knew to be falling short of all that it could be. They preached to people whom they loved, who were addicted to greed, to infighting, killing each other to prove who was mighty, and to a nation that was so incapable of uniting itself that it could offer no credible defense against foreign invaders. Do you break the hold of such addiction? With gentle words? With pats upon the head? No. The prophets shouted. They shouted because they believed that the soul of their nation, and as such, the soul of their people, was at stake. And how do you wake your people up to avoid the impending doom brought about by their own greed, their own brokenness? How do you save the people you love and give them a chance to save themselves? The prophets of the Hebrew tradition stood outside the gates of the city with wild hair and torn garments and said crazy things. And they acted like crazy people. Because if they did that, if they were provocative enough, if they were loud enough, if they said things controversial enough, someone might just stop, say, "What?" and ask what the point of it all really was. They then, after someone stopped, after just a spark of awareness got through, after the shock, the awe, the confusion, the anger, those prophets had the chance, once the bubble of apathy was burst, to say what they really meant, that Israel had the power to save herself, that justice could flow down like waters and righteousness like mighty streams, and that what God wanted of His people was not a consolidation of power, but simply to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with the Lord. The prophets were extreme in their rhetoric, because otherwise nobody would get mad, and thus nobody would care. And someone had to knock the complacent masses out of their oblivion and make them see, by rhetorical force if necessary, what the fruits of their own actions might be. They spoke in these crazy ways, not necessarily because what they had to say was in and of itself right or righteous, but because the nation was worth saving and their people were worth fighting for. They did these things because no addict breaks their bonds without difficult truths. Certainly there is a tradition within the Hebrew story of the court prophet, people like Samuel and Nathan, who held up the authority of the kingship and advised the mighty on their plans. But in the Hebrew scriptures, every single time the king fails to heed the advice of the prophet, it is the prophet who holds his ground. Isaiah was court prophet to King Ahab, right? And when Ahaz failed to heed his advice, Isaiah laid it on, saying of his own beloved city, Jerusalem, "A harlot she has become, this faithful city, Zion, that was all justice. Once intact, now assassins. Your silver has turned into dross. Your wine is watered. Your princes are rebels, accomplices of thieves. All are greedy for profit and chase after bribes. They show no justice to the orphan, and the cause of the widow is never heard." imagine a prophet saying that of their own beloved country now, having the courage. No holding back. Prophecy is an attack on the senses and an attack on society. It is an indictment in no uncertain terms of those in power who refuse to see, and as such, prophets are not supposed to be patriotic if patriotism means condoning immoral behaviors. They're not even supposed to be popular. Prophetic preaching isn't supposed to be safe or comfortable or nice. It's supposed to be dangerous, provocative, and usually blatantly overstated. The task of the prophet is to convict people of their brokenness. And a true conviction, especially of the wealthy and the powerful, is not something people are used to in this society of ours. The sins of the mighty are supposed to stay underground, largely unmentioned and unmentionable, silent and safe. And when we hear an angry black man shouting, white America gets afraid that we ourselves may be convicted. In this country, black men and women, especially African American religious leaders, have been shouting for some time. Every culture must have its prophets, and those prophets usually do not come from the ranks of the enfranchised majority. Those prophets usually come from the ranks of those who see firsthand the cost of society's corruption. And in the American religious experience, the vast majority of our prophets have come from within the family of African American churches. From the very inception of the first African American Christian churches in America, leaders like Sojourner Truth and Martin Luther King and thousands upon thousands of others whose names are not remembered have stood up in their gathering spaces and shouted to the rooftops the righteous indignation of those who are on the receiving end of a racist system. They have indicted that system and empowered one another to do something about its brokenness. And as I've mentioned before in this sermon series on religion in America, it was from the pulpits of African American churches that the civil rights movement gained its strength, and it was from the gathering of African American clergy around issues of social justice that gave fire to the breaking down of Jim Crow. Even today, white Americans look to the black church to have the courage to live out the prophetic tradition, because too often, in predominantly white churches, including this one, born out of the American Protestant tradition, religious leaders have taken on the exact opposite role from that of the true prophet. Pulpits have instead become the domain of the court prophet, the respectable voice that upholds the status quo and sanctifies the powers that be in exchange for favors and powers of its own. Mainstream white Christianity in this country has created an expectation that preachers are supposed to be nice. We're supposed to be non-threatening people who tell you things you agree with and give you some chicken soup for the soul that will get you through your week. But the descendants of the prophetic tradition, not just in African American churches, but in synagogues and in other churches all over this country, have refused to play this game, declining to turn in the prophet's voice in exchange for the power inherent in complicity. It was Frederick Douglass who said, "I will hold up America to the light and scorn of moral indignation. In doing this, I shall feel myself discharging the duty of the true patriot, for he is a lover of his country who rebukes and does not excuse his country's sins." For a prophet is a lover of her country, one who loves it too much to let its failures go unnoticed. And the simple truth that religious America seems to have forgotten is that you're not supposed to agree with the prophet. You're supposed to think about what they say, wrestle with it, disagree with it, and come out the other side stronger in your own convictions. You're supposed to be jarred out of your complacency long enough to think a new thought. Yet this concept is so lost on the mainstream American media that that media has built this entire affair with Jeremiah Wright as a window into the heart and mind of Senator Barack Obama. As if every word which comes out of his pastor's mouth is as the candidate's own. Now, you and I both know that every word that comes out of my mouth does not represent you or your perspective. If it did, if I never made you think, if I never messed up, or heaven forbid, if I never said anything moderately crazy, what kind of a minister would I be? We all know that. At least I hope we do. And although I will never be a prophet like those of whom I speak today, we know that this role as a religious leader among us, is one that comes with the responsibility to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Yet American religion has been so sanitized, so cleaned up, so polished by political correctness that when a candidate's pastor says something crazy, grounded in a crazy yet powerful tradition, the tradition of the Hebrew prophets, most Americans can't even remember what it was actually like to be challenged by their own faith. Evidence that prophecy is all but dead in our religious practice in this country. Certainly, there are preachers who know how to be provocative. But there are two aspects of the prophetic tradition that I believe most provocative preachers today have forgotten. Firstly, that the true prophets reserved their harshest invective for their own people. That the true prophets reserved their harshest words as critics from within. And they condemned not those who were powerless, but those who wielded power unjustly. And secondly, I believe that many provocative preachers today have forgot that the shocking language and the invective of the prophets was not an end in itself, but rather a beginning, a path through the apathy and toward a more nuanced truth. I can give you two examples of contemporary provocative preachers who have fallen short of the prophetic tradition on one of these counts. Firstly, let me begin, because I know are many of you thinking the name if you've been watching the news, let me begin with Pastor John Hagee, who has been only recently in the media. In his preaching, Pastor Hagee twisted the prophetic tradition using a passage from the prophet Jeremiah so that he could refer not to his own people, but to the Catholic Church as the great whore. And he professed that Hurricane Katrina was visited upon New Orleans as God's punishment for a planned gay pride parade. This is not prophecy. This is not someone speaking from within the tradition he is criticizing. This is someone twisting the prophetic tradition so that he can tear down other people and consolidate his own authority. And unfortunately, it is by far the most common form of provocative preaching that is currently practiced in this country. Secondly, as an example of someone who has not fully lived out the vision of the prophetic tradition, I give you Jeremiah Wright, a man whose preaching, in my opinion, certainly did live out that tradition, but whose increasingly erratic public appearances served in the end to focus the attention of the nation on himself rather than on his message. Rather than shocking us out of our complacency and then using that opportunity to teach us something about ourselves, he just got our attention and held it and refused to let go. In the end, the prophetic religious leader does not belong on the forefront of anybody's political campaign. Prophets should not be beholden to political figures, but must instead, as those prophets of old, stand outside the gates of the city, apart from the halls of power, shouting in something that the mighty need to hear. When candidates, religious leaders alike, court and offer endorsements, the prophet becomes nothing more than a pawn in a political game, and the awesome power they are meant to wield is subsumed by their very proximity to the mighty. Prophets speak truth to power in difficult and usually disagreeable ways. They speak that truth to their own people because they love them. And for too long in this country, religious leaders have handed over all the prophetic responsibility to a select few among us and have allowed others to twist prophecy into either hateful condemnation or cults of personality. This country needs prophets, real ones, ones who love their people too much to stop anywhere short of challenging them, ones who love this nation too much to put on a flag lapel pin and pose for a photo op wearing a cheesy grin and shaking the hand of the candidate of their choice. America needs prophets who are not beholden to any political party or candidate, but who speak the truth as they see it in the best ways they know how, and who welcome the fine art of disagreement. And perhaps in the end, prophets don't have to just be religious leaders. They can be all of us, empowered to call out truth in difficult and provocative ways simply because we love each other too much to let one another go on in blindness, addicted to that which makes us less than we are capable of being. May we shout outside the gates of the city. And when the occasion arises, may we be strange and provocative, that we may all actually hear the sound of our own voices and the urgency of our great hopes, so that together we might find a way to break through the apathy that holds us and into lives of greater responsibility, greater love, and greater strength. Amen.